everybody. I'm Tom Dorsey.
And I'm Tammy DeRozier.
And we are lucky today to have Ludwig Kinkerini with us, PhD and Associate Professor of Finance and in the School of Management at the University of San Francisco. He's a member of the Academic Council of Index IQ. And also, you know, interesting enough, he is one of the co-founders, developers of the Equal Weighted Standard and Poor's 500. And any of our clients that are listening to this, you'll know how I gravitated to that in a big way back in the year 2000. I think it was probably one of the most important products ever created on Wall Street, and it has been emulated, along the way. So he used to be the director of research at RIDEX Global Advisors when they developed that program. And also interesting enough, you guys have heard me talk about Folio FM. He's also responsible for helping develop the internet brokerage firm Folio FM that I've traded at probably for 15 years now. I maintain accounts there. It's a very interesting concept that they have there. And Dr. Kinkerini is one of the ones who founded Folio FM. So I find that pretty interesting, Ludwig.
Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. Welcome.
What we're here about today is to talk about his new book that comes out. He and I have emailed in the past. I've read his articles that he's written, and he came out with a new book that I found very, very interesting called The Crisis of Crowding. Just the name itself got me interested. When you hear me talk about the wisdom of crowds, this is a little bit different. It's the crisis of crowding. It's like when I was coming home from Florida one time, and I was looking at a magazine, and there was a pimply-faced kid talking about how he was flipping condominiums before they were even built. And I said, you know, the show's over. It's crowded.
Right.
So tell us about your book a little bit, Ludwig, and we're going to interject along the way because I found it pretty interesting. It's not just what happened in 2008, but there's some interesting personal stories along with it, with the likes of Goldman Sachs executive Jimmy Cain.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Tom. And, yeah, it's true. You know, going back, we've been at the frontier of a lot of stuff, and you've certainly been at the frontier of a lot of stuff over the last 10 years. So it's great to be talking with you again. The book, that example you gave of the person flipping condominiums is a great example. And the book, what the book really is about is what I try to do is understand the financial crisis and understand why it was so different in many aspects. And there was a lot written on the financial crisis that was sort of misleading people, let's go kill everyone on Wall Street type of mentality, rather than to really focus on some of the perplexing issues that occurred. And one of the things that came out of that was this idea of crowding, that you can have an investment space so filled with people, copycats, and a lot of people following the same strategy to where the risk in the strategy becomes tremendously different than what people expect. And so the book starts in actually 1998, where I really believe the crowding first really emerged with the failure of long-term capital. And then it goes all the way through to the financial crisis of 2008 and beyond, and kind of talks about all these events and some of the perplexing issues that occur when crowding takes place.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about crowding, you go back to the dot-com craze, and everyone in the world thought that it could never end, you know, that you always needed storage, computer storage. Cisco Systems was the best in the world, and next thing you know, the year 2000 came around, and that show was over.
EMC, I remember the cover, it said EMC storage is hot, and EMC wants to own all of it.
That's
right.
I think
it was $98 or so at the time, and then down to the single digits.
Yeah, it was a major crash, and anyone who was involved in dot-com craze back then, the internet craze, was learned a big lesson about crowding.
Yeah, I remember that well, too. I even remember, I don't know if you remember this, but remember when there was some analyst that came out with that for Amazon, now Amazon survived, but to justify their price at the time, I think it was 1999, they'd have to sell 5 or 6 books to every person in the world, and that included Africa.
That's
and,
right.
And so that was kind of the, again, the bubble-ish period there.
So what was the biggest crowd that you saw in your book and in your research? And, you know, was it crowding of the strategy? Was it crowding in, you know, housing? Was it a combination of multiple different crowds that caused the financial crisis?
Yeah, so there was obviously the biggest crowd was the one in housing. I mean, that extended from homeowners to politicians to investment banks to commercial banks to everyone. So that was the obvious big crowd that pushed the bubble. And I talk about that in the book, and I talk about some of the interesting aspects of it, including the fact that, you know, a lot of homeowners manipulated as well the markets to get what they needed. But then some of the more obscure crowding took place in hedge fund trades and investment bank trades, where there I think they're almost more fascinating and less known about, where, for example, the behavior of the space changed entirely because of who owned it. So, for example, one of the funny things, if someone asks you, we're about to go into a recession or there's a crisis, what's going to happen to the spreads of swaps over treasuries? Most people would tell you they're going to widen. You know, it's riskier. There's a flight to quality. They widen. And what happened in 2008 is they actually contracted so much so that, in fact, the bank debt was less risky than government debt. And that was – so what happened there was partly that there was a lot of crowding in this trade, and there were different holders of the different pieces of the trade. And when the 2008 crisis came, the people – certain holders wanted to sell certain instruments, like pension funds, and other people wanted to hold on to them, and it caused the market to have this imbalance where the government looked more risky than commercial banks, and it was all due to the sellers exerting more influence than fundamental value. And that was one of the particularly interesting examples. There were others, though. There were many others.
Well, what do you think about the bailouts that took place as far as the banks in this crisis? You know, Jim Rogers, a good friend of mine, mentioned that he probably would just as soon let the banks go bankrupt and then get it straight from there. That's what Iceland did. They didn't bail out any banks. They let them all go under, and they're back on a straight path already. By bailing these out, haven't we just really prolonged the problem?
You know, Tom, that's a tough one. I've been on the fence on that one for a while. You know, I see the importance of not bailing out firms because you create a precedent and you create, for example, Freddie and Fannie, you know, you probably remember this, you know, 10 years ago when we used to buy Freddie and Fannie bonds, I used to joke to people, I said, what if they go bankrupt? And all the traders used to say, they're never going bankrupt because the U.S. government will bail them out so we can buy them. And so part of the reason that we had this bubble is because fundamentally people believe Freddie and Fannie would be bailed out. So I certainly think, you know, Jim has a point, you have a point, that bailing out creates precedent, which is really bad. At the same time, when the market was collapsing, I do think it might have been good to have bailed out some of the major banks. And the reason for that is I think the financial system would have had even a bigger crash and had more consequences on the society at large. So, you know, I'm kind of, it's a tough line, but I'm undecided on this one, just because it was such a severe crash, you know. And, for example, in 98, long-term capital was bailed out, and now, technically not bailed out, it was like a Bear Stearns situation where, you know, private banks put up the money. But you know, many people criticized it then, and they said this is a terrible thing to do. But then the question is, did this, you know, we didn't have a big crisis in 98. We had the Russian default and we had to survive that, but Lehman didn't go bankrupt, even though it almost did. And so I'm on the fence. I really, you know, it's a tough call and I've heard both sides. And I do think this, though, going forward, they should set up a system which has the incentive so that banks do not want to take excessive risk thinking they're going to be bailed out like a Freddie or a Fannie. But at the same time, you know, we do have a system in place that knows what to do in those circumstances. And it's not an easy thing. How do you do that, right? It's very difficult. So I don't know. I'm kind of on both sides to it.
No, I get it.
You know, one thing I loved about the book was that it was really easy to read and informative, and I loved all the interviews. Who did you enjoy interviewing the most in the book? And what was probably maybe the most enlightening thing that you didn't kind of off the wall kind of answer that you didn't expect from them?
Right, that's a great question. I certainly enjoyed talking to Jimmy Kane of Bear Stearns, the former CEO of Bear Stearns. He's a fascinating individual. I mean, a very smart guy. he's also, you know, a great bridge player. And if you like bridge, it's fun to talk about bridge hands.
Lots of these traders are wonderful bridge players.
Yeah, sorry, what did you
say? I said lots of traders are wonderful bridge players.
Oh, yeah, it's true. And also poker. You know, it's funny. The more I learned about Bear Stearns, I learned that a lot of people either play poker or bridge. So, but he was very interesting. He told me a lot of interesting things. Some are not in the book. Some are in the book. And, you know, I guess one of the things that's hard, you know, people always say to me, but, you know, these Wall Street bankers, they're all crooks and this and that. Well, greedy, certainly they are. But one thing that you get an idea of when you talk to some of these people, and I felt I got an idea of, is that, you know, they felt that they were doing business as usual. So their business was securitizing mortgages and selling them. And it's very hard, you know, as much as in hindsight, it's very easy to say, well, you're a bunch of idiots, you screwed up. But, you know, when you're in the system, it's very hard to say, well, maybe we should stop doing the business we do. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I, by talking to people, I've realized it's very hard for them to figure out. You know, Jamie Dimon, after Lehman failed, they asked him, was Lehman bankrupt? Was Lehman insolvent? And he said, I can't answer that question. I really don't know. So, you know, that's interesting that he would say something like that. And so I enjoyed talking with him. I enjoyed, talking with some of the long-term capital traders. That was fun. You know, just learning a lot about their industry and what was going on there. So it was all very fun. I mean, I'm trying to think of some funny story that came out from some of the discussions. You know, I talked a lot about politics with Jimmy Kane. That was fun, and I won't reveal. I mean, I think people know where he stands, but I won't reveal what he said. But it was a great experience learning about the insides of different trades. I'll give you one cute story. When everyone knows about the Bear Stearns hedge fund that failed, and one thing I asked Jimmy, and this is in the book, I said to him, you know, how could no one know what was going on there? And, you know, he said, you know, I found out 5 minutes, I found out in our executive committee meeting that the head of fixed income trading had put money into the hedge funds without our knowledge. And he had violated one of the rules of the firm. And, you know, and why did he do it? You know, he probably was worried it was getting away from him, the losses. And, you know, he was fired immediately after that. But it was kind of interesting to see how these things played out.
It is always amazing, I think, that when you hear these stories about trouble and what have you in the financial institutions, that people didn't know that was happening and how quickly it seems to get away from it. Did you come away from the book feeling like, after researching and writing it, did you come away feeling that the financial system is any more secure and stable today than what we were in 1998 or before 2008? Do you think anything's really changed?
Well, so there has been one change. So generally speaking, I don't think a lot has changed. The big changes, of course, you all aware of them. One is compensation is down. So, you know, I asked someone at J.P. Morgan about 2 weeks ago, what's the number one thing you would tell people about what's the banking like, investment banking today and before the crisis? And the person said the only thing that's changed is compensation. Compensation's lower. But there is, of course, one other development, and you're aware of that as well, which is the capital ratios, the BIS. The Basel Committee came up with new capital ratios that the Fed has approved. So that is a difference. So we have banks do have more capital now, more risk-weighted capital, and hence, for the time being, they have less leverage. So that is a major change. And, you know, whether that's enough to stop a future crisis or not, I don't know, because one of the things I talk about in the book is that long-term capital, you know, started a new fund in after they failed called JWMP, which is the initials for John Merriweather, and they reduced their risk by about a third, half to a third, and they failed in 2008, or they lost a lot in 2008 because the moves were much bigger. So I would say the big change is the capital ratios are higher, which means less leverage, which means theoretically banks should be more secure, but if there's a huge move again, you know, they'll be under strain again. It's not, you know, it's so I don't know if that you know, that I think that's the major change.
Well, Ludwig, when you interviewed the government regulators, did they take any blame for this? Were they willing to say, you know, we probably caused most of it going back to Jimmy Carter days?
Yeah, you know, no one that I talked to did.
No, of course not.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that, you know, even Geithner has been interviewed tons of times, and, you know, by all kinds of committees, and he's never, ever said, you know, maybe we blew it up. You know, maybe we made a mistake here, or we made a mistake there. And you know, you look at one of the simplest things to look at was the Basel Committee's risk weightings of mortgages. They lowered that from Basel I to Basel II. They lowered it by 15%. So essentially what they did, and the Fed approved of it and everyone else, essentially what they did is said mortgages count as less risk for any bank who owns them. Well, you and I know, Tom, and you know very well what happens. What are you going to do? You're going to load up a little bit more on mortgages.
Sure, right.
So yeah, they have it. And there's, you know, it's hard to figure out. One of the things I found frustrating is it's hard to really pinpoint how much regulations contributed to this. But certainly, you know, some of those changes were, you know, very conducive to buying mortgages.
Yeah, there's an old saying, incentives work. And when you give people incentives to move the group one way or the other, that's going to happen.
Right, right. And we saw that. And I think one of the problems today is that we have to worry about today. And I wonder what your investors are thinking is the massive amount of regulations that are coming on now, which, again, one of the problems which I see, you know, should something be done? Probably yes. But one of the things that I'm worried about is that so much is being done, even in areas where that had no relation to the financial crisis. So then you ask yourself, well, is this really helpful, or is this creating, one, a slowdown of the economic system, and two, future problems down the road, meaning there might be new regulatory arbitrage in 5 or 6 years based on these new regulations?
Well, I can tell you what's happening, you know, in our industry, which is the Wall Street industry, the brokerage industry, is they're choking on these regulations, and it's making it much more difficult for them to do business, which ultimately, in the end, has to mean that the client is ill-served in some way, shape, or form. And it's just, I think, the regulations that are causing the brokers to just say, you know what, I'm not sure that I can continue doing this.
It's regulation across every industry, making it harder to do business in anything from the pool hall that your wife owns to more, you know, health regulation, smoking regulation, you know,
oh,
where
yeah.
You can have people in the, you know, it hurts lots of industries.
Well, you're entirely right. You don't realize how much the government regulates you until you have a small business like my son and wife own a pool hall. And they wanted to expand the pool hall. Then all of a sudden you realize what the county governments and the state governments would do just to expand for an extra 1,500 square feet.
Right.
You know, just amazing.
That's
yeah,
right.
Wow. And is that a new regulation or that's been there for a while?
It's just that all it did is make me acutely aware of how the government is involved in everything that you do. And even some of the requirements are just absolutely lunacy. And they still make you do it. So the cost for anyone to be in business, I often ask myself the question, hey, why would anybody want to be in their own business? The regulations are just at the point now where I don't know how they can do it. And the government wants to participate in everything you do where you make money, but if you don't make any money, they don't want to be involved.
But it's the great American spirit to want to build and grow and what have you. And
they finally stifle
that. That's true. Right.
You know, until they extinguish that spirit.
I don't think they've extinguished it yet. Do you?
Well, one of the things I talked about in my book is exactly what we're talking about. It's in the final chapter. It's not really central to the book, but it talks about regulation. I call it the Avatar life force, kind of stealing from the movie Avatar. But the idea is, one of the problems with regulation that I feel regulators don't understand well enough is that if I regulate if I regulate X, I say you can't come in the store. Well, obviously, as you mentioned, Tom, incentives cause people to do something else. And what I think they forget oftentimes is that the incentives may lead to something else that is worse. And you know, you saw it with the credit card laws. They did these credit card laws to limit the swipe fees. And what happened is now all banks are charging on deposits, minimum accounts. And so there are all kinds of new fees that are hurting customers. And so I think it's sort of these are the things that people forget, that there's this feedback through the system. And regulation here, you know, Myron Scholes was interviewed for the book, too, the Nobel Prize winner for the Black-Scholes model. And he said, he had said some joke in the book that I can't remember exactly, but it was something like this. You know, it's like when you have a balloon sort of with with a hole in it, and you plug up one hole, and then it squirts out the other side.
Exactly. So you have the unintended consequences.
For everything, right. There's an equal and opposite reactions, what you always tell me. If you
That's
do
right.
this, you got to think about what the other...
Every action is an equal and opposite reaction.
That's right.
Very good. I like that. That borrowed from physics. That's a good... Yeah, good analogy.
Yeah. So what do you think as we kind of maybe wrap up? What do you think is one of the? Do we have a crisis of crowding right now? Like, what would you think is the biggest crisis? Something that needs to be addressed.
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know if I know that, but I would say, it's hard to know because a lot of these crowding spaces, you have to really look at the space carefully to understand if there's crowding. But one that potentially could have it, and again, I haven't looked at it closely enough, but is the treasury market. There's a potential that it's there.
I was just going to say that.
Sorry?
I was just going to say that. Go ahead.
So the treasury market might have it, and partly this is because of all the Fed actions and things like that, and there could be a big, in other words, the risk in that market may be mismeasured with respect to what it really is, especially when things change with inflation and other things. Gold might be one. It's hard to tell, but again, gold prices have risen for tons of reasons. But are they rising now partly because of this mania to buy gold, partly because of worried about inflation? And who are the holders of gold, and is it overdone? And again, I haven't looked at it in detail enough, but those might be places where there could be some worry.
One of the things that we know, Ludwig, is with our clients, which are all professional advisors, that their customers, Mr. Joneses and Mr. Smiths of the world, are all looking for income in some way, shape, or form, and they want things that are protection guaranteed, so no default. Everything is income-oriented, which means the treasury.
Right.
And once interest rates, and one would think that it's going to happen in the future, we won't predict that, but if interest rates begin to rise, there'll be a big comeuppance for those who are stuck in these bond funds and whatnot.
And it might just be the equities that really make the comeback. Like you said, the equal and opposite reaction, what people aren't expecting.
Well, Dr. Kinkarini, I want to thank you very much for coming on. I don't want to take too much more of your time here. The book, Crisis of Crowding, fantastic book. You got to get a copy of it. It's in any store, I assume, right? Just right on Amazon.
Yeah, it's definitely on any online bookstore, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, whatever you like.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you very much again for coming.
This has been great. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation today and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, then we will talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.